It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
All right, it's another episode of Dearly Departed Podcast, and this one we're going to do on Greece.
Greece is the word. You know what I heard? I've heard, and now I don't know, I just read this today, that through the whole movie Greece, the word Greece is never said.
Really?
I have to watch it again, and I know that the song "Grease Lightning," you know, that shows up. But as I understand it, the word "Grease," that it never shows up a single time in the movie.
You could probably get a copy of like the screenplay or a transcript and just do a search for the word "Grease,"
which is much easier than watching the whole movie again.
All right. So it's Dearly Departed Podcast, and I'm Mike Dorsey.
I'm Scott Michaels.
And let's just get into like miscellaneous news and deaths and stuff.
It's been a while, hasn't it? And there has been some really fascinating, a pretty impressive exits in the last couple of weeks.
Seriously, yeah, a lot of newsworthy ones. Somebody reminded us that, you know, we talked about in our Sunset Boulevard episode about the Pacoima mid-air collision disaster in 1957, mm-hmm. remember? And someone mm-hmm. pointed out, we forgot to mention, that high school, Pacoima Junior High, was Richie Valens' school.
Of course.
And he was 15, so he's still a student there at the time. He was out that day. He was a grandparent's funeral. And that's why he wasn't and three kids died, a bunch of others were severely injured in it. And yeah, he should have been there, but he wasn't. He was out that day.
Richie Valens and airplanes.
Seriously.
Not a good mix.
Seriously. No, for real.
Wow. So that's fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I sent you this link. Our 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter documentary was just in an article on Screen Rant this week, yesterday, actually. And it was a ranking of the 10 best cult documentaries. And we came in number 8.
Really?
Yes.
Cult documentaries.
10 best cult documentaries. Documentaries
about
cults.
And what were the
other
ones?
That's a good
That's
host.
Great. I mean,
what is it?
Thank you to Screen Rant. That's very typically LA. Oh, who cares? We made the list. What are the other ones? What?
Who else did they talk about?
Who cares?
Number 1 was The Lost Women of Nixivm. Nixivm. I don't know that one. A Waco Doc. Wild Wild Country is number 3. That's a hell of a good documentary. Prophet's Prey was on there. My Scientology movie. There was a Jonestown one. It's an honor to be named with all these other greats.
Yeah, yeah. Great ones. I know what I watched recently was a documentary on the making of Galaxy Quest. And that was really good.
I just started watching Galaxy Quest again this morning.
Oh, funny is that?
That's hilarious. That's, I'm like, you 20 know, minutes
Mike,
into
Mike, honest
it.
To God, I had to run the Rite Aid about an hour ago, and You're the One That I Want was on the... Summer Nights was on the really? Plane. You know, I'm like, there's a lot of chick things going on right now.
Well, and there's a couple things that jumped out, because I haven't seen Galaxy Quest in probably 20 years, and I didn't realize Rainn Wilson's in it, which I didn't realize. He's one of the aliens. And Tim's house is the Stahl house.
Oh, yeah,
in the Hollywood Hills. And... an early thing where he shows up and they all decide to get on the ship and leave together. They're at this like grand opening for like an electronics store. It's the roof of the parking garage at the Peterson Automotive Museum.
Is it?
Yep. And you can see
was
the
that in this documentary? I didn't hear that.
I don't know, but it's in. I recognized it because we filmed up there for Unsolved. And so I recognized it immediately. And you can see the gold of the May Company building in the background. You know, part
Interesting.
Of it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
But they put a sign up, you know, over the doors there that lead onto the roof that says for an electronics store.
Okay.
Yeah.
And isn't that like that's where the Biggie party was held, wasn't
it? Yes, correct. Yep.
All right, okay.
That's where the party was held where Biggie was killed leaving. Yeah, and this was filmed just 2 years after that happened. Or the movie came out just 2 years later. So, yeah. You can also see that intersection where Biggie was killed in a scene from, I believe, American History X. This film at Johnny's across the street.
I haven't seen that in a long time.
You can see through the windows. And I think also a scene from The Big Lebowski. You can see that intersection in the background.
Yeah.
That's the one. The Big Lebowski one, I think, because that was shot around the same time as the murder happened. They were in production. because that movie was filmed in 97.
Really?
And the filming production dates, Biggie's murder was in the middle of it somewhere. So when you watch that movie, I think it's the John Goodman scene where he talks about, I can get you a tow. You know, I can get you a tow from anywhere, you know. And,
yes.
And the
yes.
dude's telling him to, like, calm down. And he's like, I'm calmer than you are. And out through the windows, you can see the intersection of Wilshire and Fairfax where Biggie was shot. And that is what it looked like, you know, when that shooting would have happened. Because it would have been within a few weeks of the murder. So
did we talk about that movie with Anthony Edwards called Miracle Mile?
I don't think so.
I was talking. It was this really weird movie from the 80s. It was great because the guy, he's eating at that diner, Johnny's, on the corner of Wilshire right. and Fairfax, and the payphone's ringing. And Anthony Edwards is leaving. He just picks it up, and he's told that there's this nuclear bomb headed for Los Angeles, and the entire, you know, country's going to be destroyed. And it turns out that there was a guy from, like, military intelligence that misdialed by one number. He was going to call his father, and he got that payphone instead. And the whole movie is this hour and a half of him, you know, trying to figure out what the hell they're going to do. It's really interesting. They do Pan Pacific Park before it was torn down.
Right.
Farmer's Market, all around there. But it is a really wild, good movie. It's nobody has ever heard of it, but Miracle Mile is really good.
And speaking of nuclear attacks, I just saw that Jim Carrey, I think he was on Fallon this week, and he was in Hawaii when they had that false alarm about the nuclear missiles from North Korea.
Uh-huh.
And he thought he was going to die, like everybody else did, and was like mm-hmm. basically trying to figure out what to do with the last minutes of his life. And then, you know, 2 minutes before impact.
Comedy gold.
Yeah.
Comedy gold on Jimmy Fallon.
How am I going to die? Yeah. And then, you know, 2 minutes before it was supposed to hit is when they sent the all clear that it was a false alarm and all that stuff. But, yeah. I think he said something along the lines of he didn't want to die in his car. And he went and he was just looking out at the ocean, basically, and kind of life flashing before his eyes kind of a moment, you know, kind of reliving his life. And then it turned out it was false alarm.
I can't see Jim Carrey calmly looking at the ocean and chilling. That is not the Jim Carrey I am familiar with.
So, right.
Well, that's got to be freaking scary. There's a couple of... I'm a sucker for those prank videos. I watch them all the time on YouTube. You know, the guys with the Nutella in the bathroom and there's one where the guy has a recording of a nuclear bomb being launched and his wife and he are supposedly watching it live and she's just flipping out and screaming. It's fascinating. It's terrible. If anyone did that to me, I'd kill him, but it's very funny. Anyway.
It's hilarious. Shall we do Deaths of the Week?
Deaths of the Week.
News of the Week.
Here we go. For me, number one has to be Carl Reiner, the comedy TV legend. Dick Van Dyke Show, of course. He also directed The Jerk and Oh God and a number of other films. And is kind of credited with helping launch or popularize Steve Martin's film career in the early years. And his wife, Estelle, delivered the famous line in When Harry Met Sally, the I'll have what she's having line at the end of the
film. Yeah, that was a gift. A gift from Rob Reiner to his mother. That was pretty cool.
Right. And that's such a hilarious scene. And then that perfect little, you know, cap at the end of it with her line is just elevated it. Every night, Carl would have dinner with Mel Brooks, who he was good friends with for 70 years. They were both widowers. And every night, Mel Brooks would go to Carl Reiner's house and they would eat dinner, watch Jeopardy, and then watch a movie. And to be a fly on the wall for even one of those nights.
Wow. Yeah. I wonder if they spoke at all, or if they just trashed what they were watching, or if they just intently watched. That'd be really interesting because they're both elder. They're both really old. I mean, you know, he's old, and but completely there. All the sparks
mentally.
Were, you know, yeah. It was because he always showed up in documentaries. Always. In recent years, and generous with his time, and a lot of people really respect him. A lot of people do.
Right. I would love to just see what their movie list was, like what were they watching? You know.
Yeah.
Anyways, so thoughts. You know, it makes you think of Mel Brooks because now Mel Brooks is not only now, you know, a widower, but has also lost his best friend that he was, you know, would spend every evening with. Talking to and that old guard is dying off.
Yeah. Yeah, he probably lost all his friends. That's got to be... Yeah, that sucks. That's just... There's no good way to... You know, you just... There's no one to go, hey, remember...
you don't. Right, right.
It's like, oh, there was that one time. You were there.
It's definitely a special level of loneliness, I think, when nobody's around for you to tell the old stories with anymore that remember that can be like, you know, that was there. Carl died on June 29th. He was 98. And one press report was that he died in his sleep, but his nephew, who's a talent manager and TV producer in his own right, says that Carl passed away after dinner. It was 10 o'clock a night, and he was walking out of his living room or dining room area, and a staff person was helping him, and all of a sudden his knees buckled, and he kind of fell. And then he passed away not long after that. But his last meal was a hot dog from Pink's that was named after him, called the Reiner Dog.
And so they must have got Postmates or something delivered.
Right.
Maybe Mel brought it over.
Apparently, a Reiner Dog was a hot dog with mustard and sauerkraut, and then apparently he had it with a side of beans, and that was his favorite dinner, was the Reiner Dog.
Sounds delicious.
If I had a hot dog named after me at Pink's, that'd probably be my favorite meal too, though, you know? I don't think I'd do the mustard and sauerkraut necessarily, but...
No. No. Pink's is its own animal.
Next up, Charlie Daniels, the country music legend, most famous for Devil Went Down to Georgia, passed away on July 6th at 83 from a hemorrhagic stroke.
He was in the Country Music Hall of Fame, too. I listened to Willie's Roadhouse all the time on Sirius, and that was like flags at half staff that day. A lot of people, a lot of people really loved Charlie Daniels.
And I'm not a country music guy, but Devil Went Down to Georgia is a damn good song.
It still gives me goosebumps, you know, when he talks about the devil and you hear that screech when they just rubs the, what was it that made the guitar strings or something, the violin strings, he just scratched them. And it still gives me goosebumps. It was a good song. Really great song. I love story songs. Country music is great story songs. I mean, The Night the Lights Went Down in Georgia, Fancy, you know, there's some great, you know, story songs. I love that stuff.
Right. Joel Schumacher, the famous director, directed The Lost Boys, St. Elmo's Fire, Flatliners, The Client, A Time to Kill, Falling Down, 8mm. And you look at that long list, he was one of the best, you know, one of the most famous directors of the 80s and 90s, certainly. And I saw, like, multiple headlines that basically just pointed out that he directed a controversial Batman movie. It's like, because he did Batman and Robin with George Clooney. And I'm like, you look at that guy's whole career, and that's what you focus your headline on, was that he directed what's considered a very bad Batman movie.
Huh.
That, you know, George Clooney has spent the rest of his life apologizing for being in. I even went to a screening of Argo when it came out that Clooney did a Q&A at the end of. And I remember someone in the audience asked him if he worried about his security for making this movie about Argo and Iran and everything. And his response was, no, have you seen Batman and Robin? He's like, if I survive that, if nobody killed me over that, I'm not worried about anything. So it's become a punchline for him, that movie. But I think it's a bummer because Schumacher was a really interesting guy. And he made some really kick-ass movies throughout his career. And did you read the interview he did with the Vulture last year? It was like almost a year ago. Exactly. He did a really amazing interview. And it was one of these, like, no shits left to give types of interviews, right? He was completely honest and blunt about everything. And it's really fascinating.
Okay.
But he passed away on June 20th.
Was that in Vanity Fair or something? What was that in? Do you know?
Vulture. Which I think Vulture is New York Magazine. It's kind of a must-read, I think, if you're a fan of anything Hollywood-related. It's a really fascinating interview with him. But he passed away on June 22nd. He was 80 from cancer.
Wow.
So, what a life. Started out as a costume designer and set designer and then moved into directing in the 70s.
Interesting. That Falling Down movie is... I love that movie. That movie is so messed up.
Right.
And you kind of understand, you know, what makes somebody snap. And LA isn't, you know, wasn't nearly as harsh back then as it is now, you know. And and you just cause somebody just to snap and walk out of their car on the freeway and just flip out. And and just not... I love that movie. It's so good.
And it's one of those kind of batshit movies that you talk about things that wouldn't get made today. I don't know that would get made today. Mm.
No, you're right.
Hollywood isn't in that place anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially from a major director like that.
We're going to talk about, in a minute, the show Glee. But, talk about shows that wouldn't get made anymore. This isn't that old. But anyway, we could talk about that when we get to it. But I just wanted to mention that.
Kelly Preston, John Travolta's wife and a famous an accomplished actress in her own right. She was in Twins. And Jerry Maguire, my personal favorite of hers. I thought she was amazing in Jerry Maguire. For Love of the Game. And she also, I just found out about this, she was in school at the same time, at Barack Obama's school in Hawaii at the same time that he was there.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know that they were the same age, but they were there at the same time, apparently.
Now, did she speak like Nicole Kidman? Like, she was born in Hawaii, but spoke with an Australian accent, because that's where she was brought up. Was she like that? Did people just assume Kelly Preston was from Australia?
I don't
remember. But I know that's the thing with Nicole Kidman. I think they were all born in Hawaii and moved to Australia.
Interesting.
And everyone just assumes they're Australians, but they're not.
Huh. She passed away on July 12th, age 57, from breast cancer. And I think it was one of those situations where they kind of kept it quiet that she was sick.
Clearly, yeah. That was a real surprise.
So it was a shock. It was a shock to people, I think, when she passed.
Yeah.
And this one is kind of the big one in the news still today. Naya Rivera, Glee star, who passed away on July 8th at Lake Piru, California. She was 33 and really kind of almost bizarre circumstances. She went out on a pontoon boat with her 4-year-old son and drowned. And luckily the 4-year-old was okay. But I saw you went out to the lake a couple days ago.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, the lake looks like a beautiful lake. I never knew it was there. It's an hour north of LA, and you drive through some really, it's inland, but it's this beautiful lake, man-made lake, and I guess it's like 150 feet deep at some point. It's not that big, because you could sit on one end of it or stand and look, and you could see the whole thing. So it wasn't like they had to do a search for her boat. You could have stood there at the dock and go, oh, I think I see it over there, you know?
Right.
But it's a beautiful place, but the water's so deep, and there's so much underwater foliage. There's like entire trees down there. And and they say it's notorious for being a hazard. There have been 11 drownings there, and I don't know in how many years, but they say that the underwater is really hazardous. But you're right. Hers is an interesting story because, you know, she went out for an hour-long rent of the boat, and 3 hours later, you know, she didn't come back, and they went out and looked at the boat, and the kid was sleeping on the boat, and she was nowhere to be seen. And then the kid said that she put him out, picked him out. They were swimming. She picked him out of the water, put him on the boat, and then that's the last he saw. She disappeared under the water.
He turned around and saw her disappear under the surface. Yeah.
So I can't really understand a whole lot of that because I don't know. It just seems like, well, first of all, you know, wear a life preserver, you know, a personal flotation device. I mean, that makes sense.
Apparently the kid had one on, but she didn't.
Right. And I understand a mother, I understand that a mother would want to protect their child, but if the child had on a life vest, he was going to be fine. Now, she mustered up the strength to put him up there. It surprises a lot of people that she couldn't muster the strength to hang on to a step of the something, you know?
Right.
I mean, they didn't find her for 5 days, so there's really no way we'll ever get an answer. There's no closed-circuit television on any of those boats or anything like that. But
they didn't find her like hung up on a tree underwater or anywhere you could tell, oh, I see what happened. They just have to...
Yeah.
All they can do is speculate. And apparently, like you said, it was a very dangerous lake. Locals have been trying to get signs posted for years warning people not to swim.
There are signs posted saying don't swim.
That's really?
Yeah, okay. They're there.
There you go. Maybe they put them up after this happened. I don't know. But I had read that the locals have been trying because it's so dangerous with the trees and there's rip currents. Those currents are really bad in the lake. And if you get hung up on something and there's a current, that's when you get pulled under. That's why they always say if you fall off a boat in a river, don't try to stand up. Because if your foot gets caught on something, the current is going to push you down and hold you under.
And the boat wasn't anchored either. So the boat right. was going with the wind.
It
that's
drifted.
Why it blew to the north end of the lake. So yeah, mm-hmm. that's another thing. She may have freaked out because the boat was getting too far, and you know she wanted to get to the boat with her kid and put the kid on there. But there is that. Why didn't she grab onto something? You know, if she had that, it's really sad. And there is some really beautiful memorials of people left up there. But for some reason, I don't know. It's a testament to their acting because this woman, I really liked her character on the show. Well, she was really good. She had a great voice. She danced well, and she was a good actress. I don't know. So it's sad to see somebody that young, you know, in a I don't know. It's such a bizarre circumstance.
Yeah, the story didn't sit right with me at first, and I guess the more I learned, the more I guess it was just an accident. But I mean, not that I think foul play happened, because you know they have video of her and her son going, you know, parking in the parking lot and walking, and you showed it in your video on YouTube. And you know, you see them getting on the boat and then motoring away together. Nobody else is with them. But I just, the whole thing is a little strange. But maybe that was normal for her to go up there with her son and do stuff like that. I don't know.
She grew up 20 miles from there, so that was on her radar. You know, she probably And you know what else? There's a lot of, because she's the third major cast member from that show that died in their 30s. Major cast members, but she, you know, because there's been a lot of flack about the other one, Lea Michele, and there's been a lot of cancel culture kind of stuff going after her. But everything I've looked about Naya Rivera, it seems like she's kept her nose pretty clean. She's never come out and said, you know, trashed anybody. I don't think she's ever done anything any really embarrassing at all. Mm-hmm. So which is even more sort of, I don't know where I'm going with that. But it's sad. It really made me sad. Very sad. And these things usually don't touch me that way, but it did.
Right. And speaking of the other cast members, it took them 6 days to find her body. And she was found on the 7-year anniversary of the death of Corey Monteith from the show, who overdosed. Mm-hmm. So that a lot of people thought that was an interesting coincidence, that it was right on
and
the 7-year anniversary.
And her old boyfriend was Puck, that wanted to kill himself for child porn. She was with him for like 2 years. Mark Selling. Was with Mark Selling for 2 years, and then he got busted for child porn and then hanged himself. So she, you know, it's interesting, fascinating. She said about Salling is that I wasn't completely surprised about what happened, but I was shocked by what he did as far as the suicide went. But the other thing wasn't a total surprise or shock.
Huh. Next up, another shocking and bizarre one to some extent, Steve Bing. The wealthy political activist and film financier. Financed Get Carter and Rock the Casbah and The Polar Express, which is probably his biggest success of his films. He financed Scorsese's Rolling Stones documentary Shine a Light. He was very politically connected. He was one of those guys who kind of knew everybody, kind of a dude. Some ties to Epstein and Clinton. And he jumped off his 27th floor balcony of a Century City apartment and committed suicide. And I don't know if the note was left behind. It kind of sounds like there wasn't, because they're just kind of stuck speculating about what drove him over.
You know, what a shitty thing to do to people on the street. You know, I'm really sorry you're having a shitty life. I'm sorry you want to end it. But that is really fucked up. What if somebody's just walking by, and now they got to deal with that for the rest of their life, you know?
That image.
It's just so selfish. I'm sorry, you know. I mean, I'm sympathetic and I'm empathetic to a degree too. But it's just like, oh man.
If he had some people claim that he had revealed to them that he was bipolar and he was suffering from depression off and on, and he had drug abuse problems, alcohol abuse, I think maybe, and he had talked about suicide in the past, and then this is crazy. He was dating Robert Mitchum's great granddaughter. And she died of an overdose a year ago.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, she was quite a bit younger than him. She was, I think, 25 years younger than him, but they, you know, obviously were close. They were dating. And, yeah, she died from an overdose, and they were coming up on the one-year anniversary of her death, so some speculation was that might have been tied into it. And then on top of that, he's a very social guy who's used to partying and being around people, and with the pandemic, you know, was stuck at home alone like everybody else has been. And I think it's just all weighed on him, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And everyone else that had to watch.
He's another. He's another one where there were all the headlines were that he wrote Kangaroo Jack, and it's like it's like Schumacher, and they died on the same day, I think. And it's like your whole life and probably the most embarrassing thing maybe about you is the thing that people remember you for.
Or most Americans only know him because he was with Elizabeth Hurley. I mean, that was right. You know,
and she had a son, and there was the whole paternity dispute over it, and yeah. Yeah, and he never apparently never ever met his son in person.
Stellar, just a stellar gent.
But sorry. I have friends who were friends with him, and they loved him, and you know he was a great guy. And Kelly Lynch, the actress, told a story that was in one of the, I think, Hollywood Reporter, that the first time she met him, he was sleeping on a couch at a friend's house in Malibu, and she thought he was homeless. Because he was mm-hmm. known for always just being t-shirt and jeans kind of guy, even though he was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He was mm-hmm. the heir to this big fortune.
That's right. He got when he was like 18, he got like $600 million or something.
Something like crazy like that. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Man. Anyways, rest in peace, Steve Bing. Mm-hmm. Bonnie Pointer, co-founder of the Pointer mm-hmm. Sisters, mm-hmm. passed away on June 8th at the age of 69 from cardiac arrest.
Those guys were some. Yeah, you know, they played the Ryman Theater, the Grand Ole Opry. They were the first black group to play the Grand Ole Opry. They had one country song called Fairy Tale, and I think they got booed off the stage because they weren't, you know, we're talking, you know, a different time period mm-hmm. and a different type of audience. They weren't expecting to see these, but I love his song. Fairy Tale was a great song, and I don't think they got the Grammy, but they were nominated that year for that.
Wow. Mary Kay Letourneau, famous for pedophile. Famous for having sex with she was a teacher, and famous for having sex with one of her students when he was like 12 or 13, and went to prison. And the craziest thing about her story was she got this sweet deal that she got 6 months for having sex, legally, technically raping a boy. And she gets 6 months for it, gets out, and immediately gets caught with him again, and ends up going back to prison for years. But then she got out, and they got married, and she got two kids while she was going through all these trials and stuff with him. So she had two children with him, and they got married and like had a family. What's that?
I said he had something she wanted.
Yeah. Yes. But they had in recent years they had separated and then gotten back together, and he says that eventually he came around to realize that their relationship was not healthy, duh. And she passed away on July 6th. She was 58 from colon cancer.
She had a couple of children from a previous relationship that were, you know, mortified and humiliated by the whole situation, but apparently that at the end of her life they had patched things up and had a good relationship with her previous children before.
Yeah, she'd been married, and I think he divorced her, of course, when all this happened. Yeah,
because she wants the 12-year-old. What, you know, stellar.
It's weird. She claimed she didn't know. I think she claimed she didn't know it was illegal.
Okay.
To have sex with a 12 or 13-year-old. She claimed she didn't know, and had she known, she never would have done it. Whatever. Anyways, speaking of ones that kind of deaths that kind of hit close to home, Grant Imahara from one of the hosts of Mythbusters died suddenly. I worked with him.
Through
Discovery, I got to I worked with him and the other co-hosts, Tori and Carrie, almost exactly 2 years ago. July 20th, it came up in my memories, I think, my Facebook memories. On 2018, I worked with them on a shoot down in San Diego for the Mythbusters experience, which is like a traveling museum exhibit. And then I've since worked with Tori and Carrie on a couple other things for Discovery. So super, all three of them are just incredibly nice, down-to-earth people. So kind.
Great gig.
Generous with their time. Yeah, and they got a hell of a great gig. And what's also interesting about them is both Grant and Tori had previous careers before they became famous working for ILM. And I know Tori was a model, Industrial Light & Magic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
George Lucas.
Tori was a model builder, and I talked to him about it once. I said, do you ever catch some of your movies on TV every once in a while and kind of stop? And he's like, yeah, like he built some of the spaceships for Starship Troopers. And he'll, you know, every once in a while that'll be on TV and he'll see one of his ships, you know, fly by. And I don't know, Grant was there too, and I don't know exactly what he did at ILM, but he worked on all three of the Star Wars prequels. He worked on AI, artificial intelligence, you know, with Spielberg. Coincidentally, he worked on Galaxy Quest, and he worked on the Matrix sequels. He was at ILM for 9 years, and I remember when we were when I filmed with him, he was kind of like, he was the smart science nerd of the group. If you needed something technical explained, the other hosts were kind of like, have Grant explain it, basically, because he was I think he had an engineering degree. So, but yeah, that was a bummer. He died from a brain aneurysm on July 13th. He was only 49.
Wow.
And those come on, you know, very suddenly. You know, my grandmother died from an aneurysm too, and it was just, she thought she had a headache and she went to sleep, didn't wake up. And so it's kind of, it's, there's no warning with it, you know. Dan Hicks, star of Evil Dead 2, passed away on June 30th at 68, cancer. Peggy Pope, who was a character actress, probably maybe most famous for being in 9 to 5. She's the secretary that says, "Atta girl."
The old lush.
Yeah, right. And she also was recurring in Soap, and she was in The Last Starfighter, which was one of my favorite sci-fi movies growing up.
Oh, yeah.
She was, I think she was one of the people that lived in the trailer park that the kid lived in. Anyways, she passed away on May 27th, 91, and there was no cause given, but she wrote an autobiography called "Atta Girl, Tales from a Life in the Trenches of Show Business."
I love
Isn't
that
it. Awesome?
Tales from the one movie that you'd be interested in reading about, and I did.
From the 3 days that I was on set, probably, right?
bless her, but what a great role. What a great tagline. Everyone knows it. Everyone, you know. Well, not everyone.
Atta girl.
All the gay people, too.
John Whiteley, who a lot of people may not know, but he was the recipient of a rare juvenile Oscar for the 1953 film The Little Kidnappers. And I believe he was British. And
Scottish.
Scottish. Scottish. And he apparently was not able to travel to the U.S. for the Oscars, so they mailed his Oscar to him. And the juvenile Oscar was kind of like a little thing. It was like a little mini Oscar. And he said he was so excited, but when he saw it, he thought it was ugly and said that it ended up meaning absolutely nothing to him. And he didn't stay in a career as acting, but he actually became a highly respected art historian and museum curator in the UK, and was made a Chevalier of the French Order of Arts and Letters in 2009. So he was a highly respected art historian for a career. And he passed away on May 16th, 75, and I don't know the cause.
Okay.
There you go. Bob Kulick, who famously...
Oh, the guitar guy.
Yes. Auditioned to be the lead guitarist in Kiss, but lost out to Ace Frehley. Later played with them on their albums, uncredited. And his younger brother, Bruce, also was in the band in the 80s and 90s. And Bob Kulick died on May 28th at 70. No cause was given. But when I was reading about him, it sounds like he wasn't in a good place life-wise when he died. So make of that what you will. Gene Kennedy Smith, the last surviving sibling of JFK, passed away on June 18th. She was 92. She was the second youngest in the family.
She was the ambassador to Ireland, U.S. ambassador. She was really an important part of the troubles with the IRA. You know, she was an integral part of, you know, trying to patch all that up. It's interesting.
Clinton appointed her, and she had a big roller in the peace negotiations which is interesting because, of course, her father, Joseph Kennedy Sr., was the ambassador to the UK, I believe, back around the time of the war.
Stellar individual, Joe Kennedy. Top notch.
One of the good guys for sure. Yeah. Did you watch? I watched Chappaquiddick finally. Do you see that movie? all about, you know, Ted Kennedy and the you know, driving off the bridge and killing.
Yeah, no, I'm real familiar. I don't know if I did see that movie.
It's pretty good. It's all about basically how the Kennedy clan and the lawyers and all the powerful people around them came together and to protect Ted's reputation, basically.
So it was a documentary.
No, it's a film with actors.
I have to watch that because I know it was something the Mary Jo Kopechne thing has always been something I've always been really fascinated with, and I've always wanted to visit the bridge and Martha's Vineyard and all that sort of business. So I'm definitely write that down because I want to see that soon.
It's who was in it? It was Jim Gaffigan is in it, oddly enough, the comedian. He's excellent. Ed Helms is in it. He's almost unrecognizable. He's very good.
Oh my gosh.
And Kate Mara plays Mary Jo, and Jason Clark plays Ted Kennedy. It was really well done. I mean the story wasn't that interesting to me. It's just a story of a cover up, basically. It's a story of how they kind of had to work the press, and Ted kind of made up some mistakes along the way with it, you know, not going along with what they said he should do, and he was kind of the last hope for the family as far as political aspirations go, because this happened after the assassinations, and he was kind of they were grooming him to hopefully be the president, and according to this film anyways, he didn't really want it. Did not have a good relationship with Joe Sr. and did not want to do what his dad didn't want to follow the path that his dad set out for him, basically wanted to do his own path. I'm not a Kennedy historian, so I don't know how much of that is accurate, but that's how the film portrayed it. And then I saw on your page the conjoined twins, the Galen brothers, died. They were 68. They were the longest living conjoined twins in history, in known history. Yeah. 68 years old. They died on the 4th of July. They, of course, made money pretty much the only way they could, which was the sideshow act, and helped support their whole family with that, that money. They were conjoined like at the front, basically. So they were very awkwardly conjoined, and there was no way that they could separate them. And I read that their parents had no idea they were even having twins.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that had to hurt. That really had to hurt.
You would think that would hurt a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they famously tried to...
Unless they just didn't even play the game and did it, you know, the C-section and just took it out that way, you know?
Right.
Because I mean, that would be... You're probably physically impossible to, you know, give birth to co-joined twins.
Two babies
normally.
At the same time, yeah.
Yeah.
They tried to join the Army, but were ranked 4F. Duh.
I don't know what that means.
4F is like the lowest, like you're medically not able to join the Army.
Oh, okay.
Or in their case, I think it means 4 feet.
Did they have 4 feet or did they only have two? I don't remember.
I think they had four, because I think they were connected from like below the chest down to like the crotch area, but then I think they had four legs. I could be wrong about that, but yeah. Anyways,
I just love people like that. I love physically different individuals, or not even individuals. Mm-hmm. They're not. They were twins, but they were one. I love that. I just love that stuff. It's and I love the fact that they can embrace the curiosity aspect of it that people really want to know, and I love that.
And from a health perspective, you're tied to what the other person does. You know, one of them got a lung infection, you know, a few years ago, and they almost died because of that. Because if one of them dies, the other one dies. And so I just had the thought of, like, what if one of them was, like, wanted to be, like, into fitness and stuff, and the other one was like, no, I want to get fat. You're stuck with that person's decision.
I mean, you've got the original Chang and Eng bunker. You know, one of them died, and the other one died, like, an hour later. You know, they say he was frightened to death or scared to death, and that's how he died, just of fear. But Violet and Daisy Hilton, who were another pair, famous pair of co-joined twins, they were in Freaks, and they were in a couple of movies, but they were joined at the sort of like their buttock, and one got married, you know, and the other, well, they would have sex, like, you know, the other one would be looking in the other direction. And knitting or something, reading while the other one's going to town. So is a you know they can they it's fascinating.
If that becomes your reality long enough, that's just your reality.
Yeah.
You get accustomed to that's how it is. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. There was a movie the Hilton sisters made called Change for Life, and they demonstrated that how how they would be sitting, and they could sit so their backs were towards each other, but they were still connected. And the sister would kiss a man, and the other one who wasn't kissing him would feel it. She would demonstrate.
Really?
That she'd, you know, just get these really kind of swoony looks, you know, while this one was kissing. It's just interesting. I doubt that that's true, but that's how it was demonstrated.
Some other names that passed away recently are Richard Hurd, who was Mr. Wilhelm on Seinfeld, passed away. Anthony James, who was in Unforgiven and In the Heat of the Night, passed away. Marge Redmond from The Flying Nun. Mary Pat Gleason from A Cinderella Story and Mom. Chris Truesdale from the boy band Dream Team. You big fan of Dream Team?
No. That's the first I've heard, and I don't mean any disrespect to Dream Team fans, but I've not heard that before.
You do not want to bring Team Dream Team down on you. Jay Benedict, who was in The Dark Knight Rises, passed away. He passed away from coronavirus. Mel Winkler from Doc Hollywood and Devil in a Blue Dress, and Steve Priest, who was the bassist for the band Sweet, all passed.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And then Hank Williams Jr.'s daughter, Catherine, died in a car accident last month. She was 27. That sucks.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bummer. Yeah. I looked that up. She died. She was in a car wreck. She was in a truck towing a trailer with her husband, towing a boat, I think, and lost control somehow and went across the line and rolled over, and died. And her husband was seriously injured in it as well. And then Lisa Marie Presley's son, Benjamin Keough,
mm-hmm.
who is Elvis's grandson and looks a lot like him.
Yeah,
uncannily looked a lot like him. And where did he die, Scott?
Well, Calabasas, in their home in mm-hmm. Calabasas.
Where in their home, though? What room?
Well, you know what? Following in his grandfather's footsteps, he died on the toilet. He committed suicide, shotgun to the. It was to the head. Originally, it was said that it was to the chest, but it was a shotgun wound to the head. And
Reddy put it in his mouth. Yeah.
Yeah,
like Kurt Cobain, like a cross between Kurt Cobain and Elvis, basically.
Yeah, Elvis is the only one who's died on the toilet using the toilet. There have been a lot of people that have died on toilets overdosing or committed suicide, but Elvis.
They
is
were
the
just
only
using
one.
It as a seat.
Yes, yes.
Right.
But it was so sad. He was so young, and it's just messed up. I can't. I just don't kill yourself. You know, just call somebody. Call Samaritans. Yeah. There's suicide prevention. I mean. There's options. I understand, but
that's and that's the thing when I think about like Steve Bing. You know, 27 stories is a long ways to go down, and a lot of time.
And you're thinking
think.
About it.
You
yeah,
are, and a lot of I've seen people that have jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge who have survived have said that immediately as soon as they let go they regretted it. And I feel that well about a lot of people. As soon as they let go, you kind of realize you just did a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And it's horrible. And I don't know the circumstances of his life. I don't know anything about his life. His sister is a good, successful actress. Riley Keough is his sister.
Lisa Marie Presley is troubled is a kind word to use.
Well, when your ex-husbands include both Michael Jackson and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. This flew way under the radar somehow, but Rosemary LaBianca, who was, of course, famously murdered by the Manson family the night after the Tate murders, along with her husband, Lino, Rosemary LaBianca's granddaughter was murdered earlier this month. And how was she murdered? She was stabbed.
She's stabbed to death, yeah.
Stabbed to death.
Was it Denver?
Yeah, she was stabbed to death in Denver on July 3rd. Her name was Ariana Wolk.
So she was the daughter of Susan LeBurge Struthers, Rosemary's first husband. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, the person, if I could sit down and talk to anybody in this whole case, sure, it'd be fun to talk to J.C., we're going to Sharon Tate. Susan is the one I would like to sit and talk to if I knew I could get right answers and ask her some real questions about the case.
Ask her about Tex.
Yeah.
That's what I want to ask.
About the whole, there's way, fascinating.
Because she's the one that kind of infamously has communicated with Tex Watson, right? And has tried to forgive him.
And she, there's, Susan, her boyfriend hung out at the Spahn Ranch, she went out to support Tex Watson. If there's anyone I could talk to in the regard, and I knew I could get honest answers from, it would be... It would be her. She she's got some. She's sitting on some stories.
Wow.
But anyway, the poor girl. And as amazing. I'm sorry, Mike. So the girl has an amazing resemblance to Rosemary LaBianca. If you look at those pictures, and look, we always see that one really shitty picture of Rosemary LaBianca where like there's a side with her teeth out and stuff, and it's not flattering. But there's a couple of really nice pictures of her smiling, and that
she's
girl
pretty.
Had it. She had it.
Yeah.
She was a real resemblance there. What a shame.
And luckily, if there's any good news, they've already arrested a suspect. A 24-year-old suspect was arrested about, like, I think 6 days after the murder. So it must have... Sounds like it was someone she knew or something if they zeroed in on the murderer that quickly. And they arrested him. So at least sounds like there will at least be justice.
God.
Is that it for the deaths? I mean, that was a freaking lot.
I think we've covered
everyone. That was like 40 minutes of...
Yeah.
Of people dying.
I do have one
surprise for you, Scott.
Yeah?
I got you a small gift. I don't know if something you already have, so tell me if you do. But the other day, I landed a piece of the Walk of Fame.
Oh, cool is that?
I'll hold it up to the camera for anybody watching the video. That's what it looks like.
And if anyone from the Chamber of Commerce is watching, this is just a memento. It is a copy of something.
I got it for fair and square. I was walking down the sidewalk, and they had jackhammered a section. Like, they were doing repairs maybe or something, and they'd broken up a section of it, and there were just piles of it in the gutter.
Oh, how cool is that?
Just laying there. Yeah, so I was like, it was a few weeks ago. So I, like, they're going to toss it in a dumpster anyways. So I grabbed a few pieces. So I got
Thank
you a piece
you.
Of the Walk of Fame. And you can see, you know, the bits of white that are in it, you know, the white rock, whatever that is, quartz, I think, or whatever. So, yeah, there you go. So next time
Very
I see
cool.
you,
Thank you,
I'll hand it off.
It's so interesting. The Walk of Fame, I think it was even a documentary about how they make those stars, that certain recipe, that terrazzo that they make. But the Walk of Fame is, of course, iconic, but it's also a death trap. If you ever walk there when it rains... It is like ice. It was not thought through.
It is the slickest surface you could possibly have on water, for sure, without it being frozen. Yes.
I would love to know the statistics of the slip and falls, lawsuits on the Walk of Fame. It would be really, really interesting. And, you know, they just raised the price now. I think it's $55,000 for a star on the Walk of Fame now.
It started
as an honor. And it was $2,000 or $3,000 up until the 90s, and they started going up and up. And it was $30,000 a few years ago, and all of a sudden, boom, it went up to $50,000 plus in the last 2 years for a star on the Walk of Fame. So if you get a star on the Walk of Fame, yeah, you have to qualify, but you still got to cough up $50K to do it.
Right. I'd do it.
Would you?
If it wasn't my money, yeah, I'd do like a GoFundMe.
I would say no. Give the money to somebody else who needs it. $50K for a stupid cement. I mean, I know there's the affection of it, but I don't know. Now the Chinese theater, the footprints, that would be the one. That to me is bigger than an Academy Award. That is getting your footprints, because there's only, you know, 100 and some there of all time. So that to me is a real special honor.
Do you have any hate mail?
Hate mail.
There was only the only thing I got that I don't even bother anymore. When I see them, I just delete them. But the one that I found, let's see if I can find this one. It was a comment about the I did a video a couple of months ago about Lucille Ball's grave. And because I found a tabloid article from when she first was buried, and she was in a little cremation niche at Forest Lawn, and one of the tabloids went for the headline of, you know, Lucy's family never visits her cheap grave, and I just loved it. It made me laugh so hard. So I went there and I shot some of it, and there are these crows in the background, and, you know, just cawing through the whole thing. And I hate crows. They scare me. You know, they're symbolic from Damien Omen too. You know, they peck your eyeballs out. They're just nasty.
And they're smart.
Yes. So I call them death birds. So when I was during this video, I said death birds, death birds. And so somebody wrote, crows are not death birds. They, granted ravens, provided Noah notification the water was down and provided food to the prophet Elias. The Western religionist made the crow evil, not the Eastern Orthodox world. Crows are God's creatures. So, okay, there's that one. And now this one was, I'm not sure which was, this was a response to. I mean, it was somebody's murder, and I forget which one. It says somebody.
See, you were looking at crows with your white privilege, Scott. Your Western right. white privilege view of the world.
That's don't trigger me. Don't trigger me. I'm feeling very marginalized right now. the other one was somebody wrote a comment about something I did involving somebody that died was murdered or something. It said ritual sacrifices. Hollywood is nothing but perverts, all in caps, perverts, pedophiles, drug addicts, and alcoholics. To glorify them is to worship at the altar of Satan.
All right.
That's it. That's it. The end.
I saw somebody gave us a 3-star review, but said only because there are not enough episodes.
Yeah, fair enough.
So,
and thank you for the 3-star review.
Yeah, I'll take
sorry
it.
We failed you.
Yeah, it's a fair criticism. We did take a month off, so mm-hmm. I guess we deserve to lose a couple stars for that. Go back and listen to the old ones. They're what the industry calls evergreen because they're historical based. They never get old.
There you are. Mm-hmm. The historic documents.
Right. all right. Do we want to get into the main feature?
Sure.
It's time for the main feature.
We're talking Grease, the 1978 musical. And I apologize in advance. You may be shocked by this, Scott. I had never seen the movie up until a few weeks ago.
Okay.
I watched it for the first time only because we were going to do this episode. So
really?
It was a little painful for me It was a little rough.
Really?
It had some good parts. It deserves its status as a classic, but I'm not a big musical fan to begin with, so mm-hmm. yeah, it's mm-hmm. a little tough. But it is an icon in film history. You know, it deserves its place.
It started originally as a play about mm-hmm. a high school outside of Chicago, and it is not a family story. It is not a family movie, really. If you listen to the songs your kids are, you know, singing along to when they go to the Hollywood Bowl and wearing their little 50s jackets, you know, they're talking about pussy, they're talking about rape, they're talking about, it's...
Right.
You know, the chicks will cream, you know. These are lyrics.
Fight.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
It's just... there's a lot of stuff that's in there that is really getting lots of tit. You ain't no shit because you're getting lots of tit. That's what in Grease Lightning. I mean, these are the lyrics your kids are singing along to. So I just want to say I love them. We talk about broken rubbers. You talk about a chick getting pregnant in the back of a car. You know,
right.
It's
wholesome
it's,
family it's, Disney stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. What's up, Kaniki? One guess. You know, it's like these are your kids. You know, so it's a lot racier.
His famous line, a hickey from Kaniki is like a Hallmark card or something like that. That
yeah,
famous line
yeah.
from Jeff Conaway. Yeah,
which was a real hickey, by the way. That was something he did the night of.
Really,
Stalker Channing. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But when they made the movie, because it was based on this original play, it was ran on Broadway for years. They got three of the original actors from the Broadway cast to do the movie. Being Travolta, who played Duty, who was like mm-hmm. the second T-Bird, Jamie Donnelly, who played Jan in the movie and on Broadway, and who was the third one?
Jeff Conaway was in it at one point too.
Who yep. played Danny Zuko? Although he didn't originate. Barry Bostwick from Rocky Horror was the original Danny Zuko, and then John Travolta never played a lead on Broadway. And Kaniki, and Jeff Conaway did. So when Jeff Conaway did the movie, it was like pegs taken down because he was the guy. He was the one that
right.
had the history of the show, and also he's the guy that had the song "Grease Lightning" in Broadway, and they took it away and gave it to Travolta.
And adding more drama to that, I think him and Travolta had the same manager at the same time.
Interesting.
As well.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's it was it had to be Jeff Conaway, you know, was a troubled individual, but he had to eat a lot. He had to eat a lot of shit too, you know. I mean, because that's like a real kick in the nuts to an actor who desperately wants people to like them and wants to get stuff. And rejection's hard for actors, and then to get accepted but not as what you're well known for, and then to have this taken away—it's like castration in a slow, agonizing way.
And he seemed to be one of those moody actors who wasn't content a lot of times with what he was doing. Yeah. Well, with Taxi being a perfect example. He didn't. He thought he was wasting his time and doing the same scenes over and over again on Taxi, and took for granted that, hey, it's a great high-paying job on a really popular TV series. You know, I'm sorry if you don't feel sorry if you don't feel artistically fulfilled by it, but you know, millions of people would kill for that. But he made the point that anybody could have played the role that he was playing, whereas the other characters on that show really had to be played by, you know, DeVito and the rest were kind of their own unique characters. He felt like anybody could play a dumb wannabe actor, which is what he played.
Okay. I mean, okay, that's fair enough.
But it got to be him, so why not? You know what I mean?
Yep.
Don't quit the hit, exactly. But then you add in, he had, you know, long line of substance abuse problems throughout his life with painkillers and cocaine and alcohol.
Wasn't he the first season of Celebrity Rehab? He was like the most famous of them.
And he claims that he warned Corey Haim about his prescription drug abuse. And he supposedly told Corey Haim, you're going to die, you know. And he said, Haim responded, yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not long before Haim died from prescription drugs. So
that's another one of those things where you could probably, I guess, recognize the disaster in someone else's eyes if you have that in common with them.
And they only died about a year apart, I think, too, because I think Conway died the following year. So, he might have seen this younger actor on the same spiral that he was on. Yeah.
He was in really bad shape, Jeff Conaway. When I saw him the last time at one of those autograph shows that I go to, I mean, he couldn't even walk. He was in a walker. He had this orthopedic sort of, I don't want to call it a girdle, but it was an entire wraparound support piece.
Mm-hmm.
He was in really bad shape. And surrounded himself with some really questionable people at the end, too. It was, just a disaster, a real disaster
The story where he warned Haim was he was at a party, they were both at a party at Corey Feldman's house. So, no further comment on that one. But he passed away technically from aspiration pneumonia and encephalopathy.
Mm-hmm.
On May 27, 2011, he was only 60. But his doctor, you know, who was, you know, handling his case when he passed away, said that aspiration pneumonia is common with drug overdoses. So he didn't die technically of a drug overdose, but he died of the side effects of it.
The direct cause of his death was the aspiration or whatever, but he was probably...
Which is when a lot of material from your mouth and your stomach get into your lungs, and it's something that happens when you overdose. So it was the side effect of overdosing, basically.
R.I.P., a very troubled individual.
And to your point about him being, you know, kind of, you know, physically disabled at the end, he was apparently very depressed and kind of suicidal. That's what he had kind of been reduced to, that he had had his mobility taken away from him, and couldn't live without help, basically.
There's so many ugly stories. There was somebody he was with that claimed, through her own funeral for him, and no one in the family would have anything to do with her, and wouldn't show up at the funeral. It was just really ugly. Just a really ugly, ugly bunch of circumstances.
Yeah.
It's just too bad. But, he was a troubled individual. So, rest in peace. It's kind of funny. When they were doing the auditions for Grease, I mean, I was doing a tally of the ages of the people that were in Grease when they were filming Grease.
Right.
And we were talking about how when they did auditions, they had to do a crow's feet test of the actors just to see if they... Because Stockard Channing was 33 when she played Rizzo.
Olivia Newton-John was 29.
Yeah, yeah.
She claimed she almost didn't take the role because she was concerned that she was too old.
Yeah, the screen test. Yeah, she insisted on the screen test. So Channing was 33. They painted freckles on her face. Alan Carr, the producer, saw her on camera and just walked up to her with a brown eyebrow pencil, started putting freckles on her face to make her look younger. Travolta was 23. Jeff Conaway, 26. Olivia Newton-John had her 29th birthday on the set. So, yeah, they were well past the 16, 17-year-old phase that they were supposed to be in, which is kind of another one of the funny parts about that movie, I think.
Right.
But Alan Carr, who was the producer of this movie, they did a documentary about him a couple of years called The Fabulous Life of Alan Carr. Have you seen it?
Uh-huh. I haven't, no.
He is a riot. This guy is the most over-the-top queen. You know, he'd walk around his house in caftans, and he had a disco in his basement, and he had, like, mounds of cocaine, and everybody was going to his house. It's Benedict Canyon. And everyone would go to his house at all hours. I mean, it's a fantastic documentary. Jeffrey Schwartz does it.
I think I have seen it because I'm friends with Jeffrey.
Yeah, me too. Because he did the I Am Divine documentary too.
Right. And so Jeffrey did the one on Tab Hunter.
Yes. Yes. This the Alan Carr one, because Alan Carr, you know, he did Can't Stop the Music. He did La Cage aux Folles. And he did, famously, his sort of swan song or swan dive was the 1989 Academy Awards, which is the one that set the precedent for this is how bad it gets. But to me, I think, no, that's the best it gets, because that was the greatest Oscars to me ever was that one. And that's the one we're still talking about because, you know, it started out with Snow White singing with Rob Lowe.
It almost killed Rob Lowe's career. That's how bad it was.
But, you know, it's funny because there's a woman I know. Her name is Bernadette, and she came on the tour one time, and she says, oh, yeah, my sister Eileen, she was Snow White in the Academy Awards. I'm like, your sister's freaking Eileen Bowman? Oh, my God. You know, so she brought Bernadette Eileen on the tour, and I made her sit through it because I had it on the video. There's like a 10-minute introduction to this thing. It was over-the-top, wonderful production number with Rockettes and a giant Chinese theater for a hat. And Merv Griffin comes out singing, and like he's at the Coconut Grove. And it was, they had these tables set up, like the Coconut Grove restaurant, and in the Ambassador Hotel. And then Merv Griffin singing, because he used to sing at the Ambassador Hotel, and he says, I'm going to introduce to you these immortals. And Vincent Price and Coral Brown, Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, Sid Charisse and Tony Martin, they're all at these tables, and they all get up during this production number. Dorothy L'Amour, and this is the last time these people were ever seen. And it was the last time Lucy was ever seen in public, too. That was her last appearance. So people dog on Alan Carr, but I will defend him to the end, because he knew how to put on a show. And people hated it. They just thought it was ridiculous. And it was, but that's how fun it was. Busby Berkeley's been doing it since the beginning of time, you know? It's the beginning of movies. So, I don't know, very unappreciated. I love Alan Carr. I do. God bless him. And he saw the value of Grease. Robert Stigwood, the producer, who was on a roll, he went straight from Grease to Saturday Night Fever. Stigwood was the producer of these things, and Alan Carr was involved in all that. And both Grease and Saturday Night Fever, like the two top-selling soundtracks of all time, or one of them, anyway.
Yeah, Olivia Newton-John set at the time, she was only the second singer in history to have two top five Billboard hits at the same time, and they were both songs from the movie in 78.
Both of those songs were written for the movie. There were three songs that were written for the film that weren't in the original play. You're the One That I Want, which was released before the movie as a single, and it was a hit song by the time the movie came out. And Hopelessly Devoted to You, which was up for an Academy Award for Best Song and lost to Donna Summer, Last Dance. And the other one that they made for the Hopelessly Devoted to You, Summer Nights, and
Olivia Newton-John performed that song at the Oscars, I believe, too.
Oh, did she? Hopelessly Devoted to You?
Yep.
But it is interesting to note that there were some people that were up for the roles that wouldn't take the parts. Henry Winkler was offered the role of Danny. Carrie Fisher was offered the role of Sandy. Lucy Arnaz was offered the role of of Rizzo, but she was, and I forget why she didn't do it. Huh. Harry Reams from Deep Throat, he was going to be Coach Calhoun, and then the producer said, no, we can't have a porn star in this movie, so that's where they got
Caesar. Yeah, in our wholesome musical.
Yeah, and he wanted Alan Carr, God, I love Alan Carr, he wanted Andy Warhol to be the, to be like a one of the teachers at the school. I mean, he was like, you know, it was cool. He, I love Alan Carr. He was so ridiculous. And you know who else was in it? Michael Biehn. Michael Biehn, B-I-E-H-N. I knew him because he was in a weird slasher movie in the 80s called The Fan. He was in The Abyss. He was in The Terminator. And his first movie part was in Grease. And he's an extra. There's a point where there's a scene when they're at the science lab and somebody, he pulls a frog out of what's-her-face, Patty Simcox's purse. And then there's another scene where John Travolta is auditioning to be in different sports, and he plays basketball, uh-huh. and some guy takes the ball from him, and Travolta punches him in the stomach. That's Michael Biehn, who
plays okay.
So it's kind of cool that they have it's like a little cameo of somebody on there. Mm-hmm. And but anyway,
Frankie Avalon was in it.
He didn't want to do it because he didn't want to be typecast, and because it was a teen idol, you know. She shows right. up pondering her future as a beauty queen or beauty beautician, and he said no, I don't want to do it. But then he reconsidered it, and it ended up being his most requested song. So, but I remember when Grease came out, because I saw it several times. Of course, I did. And but Beauty School Dropout, when that came out, that was everyone's bathroom break. I remember that so vividly. This everyone's like loving the movie, and as soon as that song came on, it'd be like 50 people going out to use the bathroom. It was like their it's like their little intermission.
Did you ever go to the sing-along?
I can't believe you didn't enjoy this movie at all. That's so funny.
I enjoyed a few parts of it. It's not that I hated the whole thing, but it was a little tough. Have you ever gone to the sing-along screenings?
No.
They did. I think they released it like 10 years ago, or for one of their anniversaries. They did like a new theatrical release, and they did sing along, you know, kind of like with Rocky Horror, right? They did these mm-hmm. like sing along screenings,
which is another one you wouldn't want your kids to do, you know. So weird. Here's little you know, Becky from Minnesota doing touch me in a bra. You know, it's like, no, it's so funny that, you know, people look at Pretty Woman as another one of those movies, like, oh, I love that movie, it's a rom-com. It's really raunchy, you know. I mean, that's right. Not a judgment, but it's really, you know, it has her going down on Richard Gere during the movie, and it's pretty trashy. So it's just fascinating to me that people are, you know, sort of being able to remove that part of it.
It's like I think Sting has commented on people using Every Breath You Take as like their wedding song, and it's like, it's about stalking. Mm-hmm. It's not a healthy love song. Like,
no. And what's the other one? YMCA. People. YMCA is about guys getting off in a bathhouse. You know what I mean?
Bruce Springsteen's "Born in the USA" is not a positive patriotic song.
No,
it just has a patriotic sounding chorus.
Or another one is when they play White Lines at weddings. You know, I mean, it doesn't take that long to figure out White Lines is really about cocaine,
what the lines are of. I mean?
You know, but it's just, listen to the, you know, lyrics for 5 seconds. It talks all about it, you know, about the drugs. And it's not even masked. I mean, it's literally about the drug. And, anyway.
That's funny. I was going to say, I read that there was... There is a lost shot that was supposed to be at the end of the movie that was due to a lab error was lost, and there was supposed to be a final shot of a final kiss between Danny and Sandy at the end of the movie, and the lab or somebody accidentally destroyed it, either not realizing that there wasn't another print of it or destroyed their only print. And apparently there is a version of it that is in black and white that they do still have, and they've several times over the years have attempted to colorize it so that they could add it back into the film, and so far they haven't liked how realistic the colorizing looks, so they've never done it. But there is a lost shot of them kissing at the end, and apparently they couldn't get the budget to go and do a pickup scene for it, so it's just not in the movie.
You mean the car really didn't fly at the end? That was really bad. That was really, really bad. That one, I'm on board with that. I thought.
I think they were supposed to kiss, like, because they're in the back seat or whatever, right? And I think there was supposed to be one last shot of them kissing, and that shot got lost.
So
you didn't get the last kiss. You would think, though, with technology today, that they could colorize it realistically enough now that it would be believable. Yeah. I mean, they can create actors who are dead on screen and have it be pretty believable. You'd think they could colorize it, but so
they released
maybe one of these days they'll do it
in 4K not that long ago. I didn't get it yet, but you know what I did get the other day on 4K? I don't have a 4K TV, but I have Blu-ray. And I just got the new edition of Jaws that came out.
Oh, right on.
If I love it. It's really one of my favorite movies ever. I've probably seen it 20 or 25 times. Mm-hmm. It's like watching a new movie, and I'm not even kidding. This movie is everything. You can see the hairs on everyone's head.
Wow.
You can read every sign in the background. I mean, it was distracting because it was so good.
Because it's like you're seeing it for the first time almost.
Yeah, I watched it on the 4th of July, and I had an old DVD copy, and it was like, I really enjoyed it. I watched it again like 2 weeks later, and I was like, my eyes were popped out of my head. This is so, I'm seeing stuff I didn't even know was there. I'm hearing stuff, conversations mm-hmm. that I didn't know happened in the movie. It's really good. I cannot recommend that enough.
I have a 4K setup. I have the 4K player with the 4K TV, so I've started getting 4K discs. And the funny thing is, normally I found with older movies like that is all you get is just more film grain. It's basically, there's not that much extra resolution, really. But that's really interesting to hear that Jaws, they did a really nice restoration job.
Unbelievable. I don't know what they're going to do for the 50th, because this is the 45th anniversary this year. But what the hell are they going to do then, you know? Have a 3D?
They'll release it in 8K, yeah.
Oh, my God. No, it was, I mean, I heard, you know, I could hear the things that the chick was, when she was getting eaten, you know, she could say, oh, my God, it hurts. I never heard her say that before. But, you know, you could, they did the sound. Oh, mm-hmm. It was amazing. I cannot tell you. It is like watching a whole other movie.
And every time I watch it now, I think about that that case about the girl that was murdered. I think we've even talked about this in one of our earlier episodes. They had a there was a girl that was murdered. Her body was found along a road there, near where the film was filmed, and she was there at the time that the film was being made. And somebody thinks that they spotted her in the movie as an extra.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I've never heard this story before in my life.
she passes by in one of the crowd scenes at like the beach or at the dock or something on the pier or wherever it is. He claims you can see her, but it's really in the eye of the beholder. I mean, she's dressed similarly to how this woman was dressed when she died. But
is this real? Have you looked this up at all? Or is
Yes. It's a real theory. I don't really buy it, but they've shown the screenshots from the film. You can see the girl that they think is the girl that was murdered, and that maybe there's a clue in the movie to how she was killed. I don't even completely believe that it's even her.
It's like the Munchkin hanged himself at the Wizard of Oz, you know.
It could be anybody, so I don't really buy it. But it's interesting that people have given that theory like some air.
I didn't, you know, and maybe watching it in 4K will answer some questions too.
That's a really good point.
Perfect faces of people that I didn't even know, you know, existed in the movie, and you see them smiling 50 yards in the background. I mean, it's bizarre.
Jaws mystery: did long unknown Lady of the Dunes Cape Cod murder victim appear in movie scene? So if you look up Lady of the Dunes and Jaws, if you Google it, you'll find this whole story. And there's a guy named Joe Hill, who's author of Strange Weather, has a theory linking the longstanding Cape Cod murder mystery to his favorite movie, Jaws. Oh, and if you go on USA Today's site, they have a screenshot from the film that shows the woman he thinks is the girl.
Wow, it's not a very well-known story. I have my eyes and ears open to everything Jaws related because I just love the movie so much. But I'm surprised. So yeah, definitely going to look into that. Definitely.
I'll link the article on our Facebook page when we put this out.
I got to meet the chick who was the girl that got eaten at the beginning of the movie. Her name's Susan Baclini. And and I had a rubber hand, a severed hand that I had her on grab. And she wrote it. She signed it, "Eat me."
Yes, that's amazing. Was that at like a convention?
Yeah. I mean, that's so cool because they have you know, so many people. That'd be a really interesting one to do. We should do that, a Jaws one. I'd love to. Let's not talk about it anymore. Let's just do a Jaws one.
So save it for the
Seriously.
Jaws episode. That would be great.
Totally into that. That'd be a good one. That'd be a really good one.
I think that'll be our next show. Will be Jaws.
That'd be good.
Do you want to talk about Sid Caesar?
You know, Sid Caesar was. He was. God, they call him the Charlie Chaplin of television. I mean, he was. He was really at the forefront of it.
And speaking of Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, they were both writers. You know, they early in their careers were writers under him, as was Neil Simon, Woody Allen, Larry Gelbart, who went on to co-create MASH, was one of his writers. He was like a writer's lab for all the great comedic writers that came out of that generation. It's crazy.
Yeah. And he was another one. I really enjoyed him when he acted normal, you know, like a normal person. Because he was one of those people like Jim Carrey and like Robin Williams that could just go, they start going off on one of their tangents, and I just got to walk away because it makes me so uncomfortable because they're so intense.
Right.
And they're
right.
so everywhere. You can't predict what they're going to do, and it really makes me really uncomfortable. But he is, but I like him when he's being a person that is reined in, that is doing a role, because he's been in some fun movies too. He'd been in a lot of Mel Brooks stuff actually. I remember he was in Silent Movie. He was in History of the World Part One. He was in I think he was in Airport 75. He was in both the
It's
Grease
a Mad
movies.
Mad 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 World.
Yeah, which is another. You know, there's another one I could go on about for a couple of hours with all the people that are in that movie. So he was a well-regarded television genius. He and Imogen Coca, your show of shows, they were television gold, really, really.
He passed
away. The Munster's Revenge. That's the one I never want to forget. He was in the Munster's Revenge movie. It's a good movie.
Was that one of the TV movies they did, the reunion movies?
Yeah. They might have even did. They may have even done a theatrical release. I think that might have been theatrical.
Oh, wow.
The Munster. Yeah. I think it was. And that was cool because you see them on color. Yeah, it was the first time we saw Lily Munster and those guys in color. That was cool. That was really cool.
He was also in Vegas Vacation. And he passed away on February 12th, 2014, 91, another one of these guys that lived into his 90s, after what was described as a short illness. And tragically, his son was a doctor. And this is interesting. Sid Caesar was 6'2". His son was 6'8". And was an MD. And he died just a few months after Sid did from complications following a surgery, they said.
So, interesting.
Yep, barely outlived his dad. That's a bummer.
So, a couple of other fun facts about the movie, which I learned afterwards. The Pepsi was a sponsor of the movie, and there's a couple of points where Pepsi show up in like when Olivia Newton-John singing her song. There's a crate of Pepsi behind her, the logo. But what they overlooked was when they did the diner scene. That in the background is a big Coca-Cola sign, and they had to blur it out. If you look at the movie, I mean, here's this huge Hollywood production movie, and it is literally blurred out. It's like front and center, right in the middle of the screen. It's funny. But I didn't realize that even back then that products were doing sponsorships in movies in 1978.
That is really interesting.
Okay, so you know there's that song that Stockard Channing sings, "Look at Me, I'm Sandra Dee," where she puts the blonde wig on and pretends to be prim and proper and sweet.
Is that the sleepover scene, like the slumber party?
Yeah. So they changed the lyrics of the song for the movie because the lyrics were about Selminio, and she says, "Elvis, Elvis, let me be. Keep that pelvis far from me." Well, originally in the play, it was, "No, no, Selminio, I would never stoop so low." And they now keep your cool. Now you're starting to drool. Well, they took that verse out because Selminio was murdered the year before that. So they changed it to Elvis. And while they were filming the movie, the very day they were filming that scene is the day Elvis died. So they were they learned that Elvis was dead, and in the movie that same day they're seeing after they got the news that Elvis let me be, keep the pelvis far from me, which is kind of funny. So there's they tried to avert some sort of weird politically correct crisis or sensitivity issue, and boom.
And I just realized I knew my birthday was coming up, but in 2 weeks I will turn the age that Elvis was when he died.
Oh, really? Okay.
He died at 42. Yep, I will be 42 in a couple of weeks.
Wow. 42.
I know.
Good for you. Good for you. So, wait, what year were you born?
78. I was born the same year as Greece.
Okay.
I'm as old as Greece.
Interesting. Okay, all right. So, it's really your look, the whole thing. It is all influenced by your birth.
That's
the
it.
Whole thing. Now, okay, so we talk about Eve Arden. Eve Arden was another, cut from the same cloth as Sid Caesar, except more sane, but she was another legend of television, you know. She was the principal in the movie, right? Yes, that's right. She was like the American Maggie Smith, you know. She and Maggie Smith had that look of contempt or disgust down, you know, right. to a T. And her real name was Eunice Queedens, which it's like one of my favorite original names ever. But she was tight with Lucy. really tight with Lucy. They were best mates, and Armis Brooks was the television show that put Eve Arden on the map, and that was a Desilu production after I Love Lucy.
Do you think her and Lucy ever watched Jeopardy together?
God, do you know what? Lucy was a freaking game show monster. I was just watching her on some weird show she was so competitive, but she always went on those game shows, and she took that shit really seriously, and not in a nasty way. She's fascinating to watch. I forget what was this. It was Richard Simmons was on this thing, and it was like a charades thing, and it's really fascinating. But Lucy was a competitive player.
I was gonna say I could see how it would be in her nature to be competitive naturally. So
yeah.
You can see on any situation. Speaking of game shows, we mentioned Steve Martin earlier. I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but he went on the dating game show 3 times. You know, the one where there's the three guys and the girls behind the wall and whatever. He went on that show 3 times, and he claims all 3 times he won.
That would be difficult to find if you Google.
That was in the late 60s, early 70s, before he became really famous.
Yeah.
And he you can actually find one of them. I have seen it's on YouTube. It's really interesting, him on the dating game, and
the dating game, which was got Farrah Fawcett, Tom Selleck, Anne B. Davis. I've watched one with her. Rodney Alcala, the serial killer. He was on an episode like after he killed 3 people and before he killed others. And Agnes Moorehead, I mean, these insane people showed up as guests on the dating game. And a lot of people like Steve Martin before they got famous, because Steve Martin was a hugely successful writer, you know, for the Smothers Brothers.
Right.
And
he was already writing at the time. At least when I watched the one that's on YouTube, he mentions that he's a writer for, I think, the Smothers Brothers.
Shot it there. They probably shot it. It was like the next stage over on CBS.
Right, just walk
Beverly,
over and do the dating game.
Yeah, but we need someone.
It's common, though, for even today, for these, you know, reality shows and, you know, game shows and stuff, for people, to, you know, aspiring actors, they go on these shows to get screen time, you know, to get their face on TV, and then eventually they get, you know, famous. So that's me again with the sirens, sorry.
But I love that show. It's a fixture. It's a definite 60s fixture. So Eve Arden died... she was in the famous Lucy episode where she goes to the Brown Derby and with William Holden with the spaghetti and the scissors.
I think we've talked about that as many times as we've talked about Manson somehow.
Okay.
That specific episode. I don't know how. She's in that?
Yeah, because she says, I don't know, she sees Eve Arden. She goes, did anyone ever tell you look like Eve Arden or something like that?
Oh, interesting.
But it was another, it's deadpan. Eve Arden was totally deadpan. And she passed away up in the Hollywood Hills at November 12th, 1990. She was 82 years old, and she's buried at Westwood with her husband Brooks West.
And she died from heart disease.
Yeah, and Dodie Goodman, who was the kooky secretary in the office, she was I read this description of her voice that somebody, a Tweety Pie cartoon bird. strangling. No, wait a second. Let me get this again. They described her voice. A Tweety Pie cartoon bird strangling on a peanut. Is how her voice was described. But a lot of that stuff was ad-libbed. The stuff with the typewriter ribbon and, you know, in the office. That was, they, you know, both Eve Arden and Dodie Goodman were like old pros, you know. They were like practically vaudeville, the stuff they were doing, you know. And then the director let him go. The director, Randall Kleiser, he's the guy that he directed John Travolta in The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. And and that's how they met. And he directed Grease. But they said that he would just let the old-timers go. They knew how to ad-lib. They knew what they could do to get a good laugh. And Dodie Goodman and Eve Arden were two of those people that they let go. And thankfully so, because there were some pretty funny parts that they did together. And Dodie Goodman passed away. She was also in Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. I mean, that was a soap opera that was really, really groundbreaking in the 70s. A bizarre Norman Lear soap opera drama. Insane show. There's a child preacher, a guy drowns in a soup bowl, a country western singer in a wheelchair, and the Fernwood Flasher, Victor Killian, who's an 80-year-old, you know, he would expose himself to people, and a sitcom. I love that. But she was in that anyway. I love that show. And she actually died in June 22nd, 2008, at the age of 93. She was also a regular on the Mary Hartman Entertainment Hour. In 1979, she had her own TV show, Mary Hartman, like a variety show, and she was a regular in that.
Huh.
But I love Dodie Goodman. I think she's a hoot. There were a ton of people that were just like blips on that. You know, Alice Ghostly, who played Esmeralda on Bewitched, we talked about her. Mm-hmm. Fanny Flagg, who was played the nurse, who went on to write Fried Green Tomatoes, and she was another one of those people that was on like every game show in the 70s and the 60s. There were some Jamie Donnelly. She plays Jan, who does the brush up, brush up, brush up thing. And I got to know her briefly. She was in the original Rocky Horror Show at the Roxy. She played. She was Jan on Grease on Broadway, but she was also in the LA production of the Rocky Horror Show when it came to town for the first time, and she played the girl that sings science fiction double feature at the beginning of it. And she goes to the same church I go to too. And I was like, I was, you know, looking at the people who are going to be doing the readings. I saw Jamie Donnelly. I said, no, it can't be. It can't be freaking Jamie. Only in LA, you know, you're going to go to church and you see Jamie Donnelly, go, there's the chick from Greece. That's, you know, I love that stuff. Anyway, sorry. I'll stop. Dinah Manoff, who played Marty, she's the daughter of Lee Grant, the actress from Valley of the Dolls. Eddie Deason, who played Eugene, the nerd. You know, he is like Pee Wee Herman. I mean, that is just straight up Pee Wee Herman with the white shoes and the little tie and the you know, and Eddie Deason, interestingly, still around. He had some health scares this year. Actually, he had open heart surgery in January. Eddie Deason is straight, okay? I'm just saying, stereotype-wise, you know, he'd be a guy, oh, that's the gay one. You know, but no, Eddie Deason was straight. But the guy who was gay was Craterface, Dennis E. Stewart. He was gay. And he died. It's interesting. Somebody on my tour came around one time and said that, oh, yeah, I used to hang out with him. He was gay. He used to go to the bathhouse and cruise guys together at this place on Fairfax. And I'm like, okay, where's that? 725 North Fairfax. It's J.C. Brings old salon. The upstairs of it was a gay bathhouse. I found the ads for it. It was called Basic Plumbing. And it was, and I think the ads, I swear on my life, I just found the ad. It says, and this would have been Jay's office, okay? Jay Sebring's office. And the ad for it said, we've opened up the top floor for your pleasure with new private rooms and showers. So this is...
Unbelievable.
You know, isn't it? Isn't it wild? In Jay Sebring's salon. So anyway.
This would have been afterwards.
Well, the ad that I saw was for the fifth anniversary of it, and this was in 1982. So it would have been around since 70...
So it was about a decade afterwards, roughly, yeah. Wow. Yeah. So it was about a decade after the murders, after Sebring died.
A decade after Grease was made. No, it was actually at the time Grease was made.
It was the time of Grease, but about a decade after the Tate Manson murders.
Right, yeah.
So it wasn't, I'm just trying to establish, there was not a gay bathhouse there likely when Sebring had a salon there. It came along afterwards, yeah.
Yeah, and I first heard about it in a John Waters book. He wrote about this place at 725 North Fairfax. I'm like, really? And it took a long time, but I did find an ad, and that was all I found. But that's interesting. But this guy who was on my tour told me that, and that Eddie Deason told me that he and Dennis Stewart would carpool to Greece to go to the shoots for Greece, because Eddie Deason would have to take the bus everywhere. Eddie Deason is Eugene. I mean, he just is Eugene. He is the most kindest, nicest little nerd in the world. And am I keeping you up, Mike?
No, I'm sorry.
Sorry, don't mean to interrupt. No, that's okay. I'm messing. So anyway, but he had HIV and he died of pneumonia in April 20th of 1994 at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Wow. And I think we've touched on most everyone that I wanted to talk about. Michael Tucci, who played Sonny in the movie, I get him confused with Stanley Tucci. I thought they were the same person for some reason.
Right.
You know?
I had to look that up too, yeah.
Yeah, because it was like, oh, that makes sense. They kind of look alike. Oh, no, they weren't. Maybe they're related. I don't know about that. But
right.
So I guess as a postscript to this whole thing, a couple of years ago, we know Olivia Newton-John has been battling cancer on and off for several years. And I believe she's in remission now again. But she had auctioned off her jacket, her leather jacket, and her spandex pants that she had to be sewn into for the movie. And they had an auction a couple of years ago benefiting, you know, whichever organization, cancer organization that she chose. So the actual pants were purchased by the woman who was the founder of Spanx. Which is
no kidding.
They're framed like at the Spanx International headquarters for $162,000, and the jacket was sold for $243,000 to a fan who bought the jacket and gave it back to Olivia Newton-John, which is like, okay, that's nice. You know, she probably didn't give a shit. You know, it was a job that she had 40 years ago. But yeah, they bought it. He bought the jacket, and she's like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing. This is so generous of you. You know, she probably was like, thank God that thing is out of my life. You know what I mean? Someone out there will appreciate it now. Now she's got it back again. It's like, shit, now what am I going to do with this thing? But I hope they give it to the Academy Museum when it opens up, because that would be a really cool
addition. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Maybe if it ever opens up, yeah.
Yeah. They're going to have some amazing stuff in that museum. I mean, they got that. Mm-hmm. They got the shark from Jaws, or one of them, one of the original casts.
I think they got the ruby slippers.
Yeah, that's. I can't wait till that museum opens up.
I know it's always been a shock that we didn't have a top notch fully funded Hollywood History Museum in Hollywood, and it's nice to finally get one.
Yeah, and I hope it doesn't end up like the Smithsonian, where, you know, you hear they have stuff and it's like it's put away and you never see it again, you know.
I mean, it's the, a lot of museums like that. Peterson's like that. They have their vault, the Peterson Museum does. Although, I filmed in the Peterson Museum a couple weeks ago, and I had not been in it since the remodel that they did a few years ago. And I have to say that there's a lot more interior space now for the exhibits. Yeah. I feel like they have a lot more on display at the Peterson now than they used to, and it's really freaking cool.
The Peterson Auto Museum was an odd setup. You know, it was shaped strangely on the inside. So
it wasn't set up to be a museum. It was set up to be a department store, I think, originally.
Oh, okay.
And that was their problem. So when they remodeled it, they made it more like a museum space. And also, I remember noticing when I was there that they had like a movie cars area that was really small. There were only a few cars in it. And now, like, the entire first floor is movie cars. And their movie car collection is really cool. I sent you a picture. They have a Batmobile in there. They have the Joker-mobile. They have one of the original DeLoreans from Back to the Future that was used in all the movies. They have the yellow VW Bug from the Bumblebee Transformers movie is in there.
Mm-hmm.
They have the Tim Burton Batmobile. They have like some really, really cool. They have some of the futuristic cars from AI and Minority Report, I think, and some other just really cool stuff on display there now. So I feel like the remodel was a good thing for them.
Cool. I know that they had to, they sold a lot of their collection too to do the remodel. So they still have the Pope Mobile. That was like one of my favorites.
I didn't see it when I was there. They might. Okay. I don't know. They and then of course they have their vault is ridiculous. Like they have Steve McQueen's Jaguar race car in the vault, which is worth tens of million. You know, it's probably a $10-20 million car on its own.
Oh, did you see that the two cars from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood are going up on the auction block?
Yes, I want the Cadillac so badly. I can't even tell you. I want that Cadillac so bad. I used to own a 76 Cadillac that was very similar to that
really?
One. Just a big boat, and it was so fun to drive. And when you'd roll the windows down, there was no center post. So if you rolled the front and back windows down, it was just wide. It was almost like having a convertible with the top on. It was really wild.
That's cool.
It was such a cool car. And to have a car like that again and have it be the one, you know, that Brad and Leo cruised around in. Yeah, that I would love to have that car. So I'm jealous of whoever's going to get to buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really I mean, it was used in Reservoir Dogs, wasn't it? I mean, it was.
Was it?
Yeah, it was Michael Madsen's car. He owned it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He got it at the end of the movie, and then he let Tarantino use it for this movie, and now it's going on the block.
That makes it even freaking cooler, man. Yeah. Now I want it even more than I already did.
I know. A real chunk of Tarantino history.
Because they had that car and the Carmen Ghia both on display outside the Arclight Cinerama Dome when the movie was out. And I remember going out and seeing it there in front, right on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. Cool. That's awesome. And also, just actually, there is a perfect Tarantino way to wrap this thing up right now, because in Kill Bill, the yellow pickup truck is called the Pussy Wagon, and that's right off from Grease. And up until a couple of years ago, it was in Tarantino's driveway for years.
Right.
And,
I remember seeing it.
Yeah. And I think that was actually, I'm really proud of that segue. That worked out really, really well. So Tarantino still owns the yellow pickup truck from Kill Bill, which says Pussy Wagon, which is a direct thing to John Travolta, because he was a huge John Travolta fan. In fact, I think in order to hire John Travolta for Pulp Fiction, he made him sit and play the Welcome Back, Kotter board game with him. That was like his audition to be in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, because I think Travolta had a story that he came over to Tarantino's apartment.
Yeah.
Like Hollywood, West Hollywood, the Fairfax District kind of general area. And I think it was, I think Travolta said he had had that apartment. Same apartment that Travolta had lived in years and years earlier. He knew the layout already.
That's so funny. That's cool. Wow. Well, I think that we're greased out. I think we've covered everything.
I think we've said grease in this podcast more times than they said it in the movie, apparently.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. But it was fun. I enjoyed this. This was good.
And I think a Jaws episode should definitely be the next one.
Yeah, I agree. That'll be a fun one.
And we'll see if they say grease and Jaws at any time.
You know what? Get the 4K and watch it.
I do need. I should definitely add that to my collection.
Because you'll hear all kinds of shit. I was like, what?
I got Groundhog Day on 4K, which is not what I would have thought to get in 4K, but it actually looks freaking great. It looks really good. And there's a director's commentary on it.
Oh, wow.
Which is really interesting. And it might be on the Blu-ray as well, I don't know, but the 4K one has a director's commentary with Harold Ramis, and famously Harold Ramis and Bill Murray fell out and stopped being friends on the set of that movie. They had a big creative differences to an extreme over how that movie should go. Bill Murray wanted it to be more of a moody movie and to kind of take more of a serious approach to some of the themes that they were exploring, whereas Ramis wanted it to be a straightforward comedy. And it got to a point where, according to Ramis's daughter, she was, I think, a teenager at the time, and spent about a week on the set, and she said at one point her dad uncharacteristically lost his cool and physically grabbed Bill Murray and shoved him against the wall, and they stopped being friends. And you know, they had been friends and creative partners for like 2 decades up to that point, and stopped being friends because of that movie, and did not reconcile until Ramis was on his deathbed. And Bill Murray's brother, who plays the mayor in Groundhog's Day, was the one that convinced Bill to go and, you know, patch things up with Ramis before he died.
And so Bill Murray's an anomaly. I mean, he is. Mm-hmm. I can see how he pushed somebody's buttons enough to make him react that way. But I also know so many good things about him, too, because, I mean, he irritates me, but I understand that, and I get where he's coming from. And I think Ramis probably did eventually, too.
I would say probably the best commentary on Bill Murray is that Ramis said about their falling out, according to Ramis's daughter, he described feeling variously heartbroken, confused, and yet unsurprised by the rejection when Bill Murray stopped being friends with him. So I think there's a lot in that, there's a lot in that description, I think, that tells you a lot about the two of them. Yeah.
And one thing about Murray is I don't think for one second he denied any of it. You know, he was so self-aware, and he's got his own, you know, principles, be them, you know, they're his own. And he sticks to them. I just think that's he's very aware of his own commodity. And the stories are legendary, how he'll just like, when he was in some Singapore and there was a wedding going on, and he walked up and he stuck his, did we talk about this? Where he went, they were taking pictures and he walked up and all he said was, you're never going to, they'll never believe you or something.
Yeah,
like
and then it became a thing on the internet where people started kind of making up their own Bill Murray stories based on that, you know what I mean? Like Bill Murray took chips off our table and said, they're never going to believe you, and walked away and stuff. And so it's like, there got to be a blurring between what's real and what isn't. He joined a kickball game that was in progress in New York one time, apparently ran up and just kicked the ball and then kept going.
Like, I love it. Like,
but I know friends of his, and they said that basically Lost in Translation is what it's like to hang out with Bill Murray, because you don't know where the night's going to go, and you're going to do things that you think, are we going to get in trouble? And he's like, no, don't even worry about it. Like, people love me, don't worry. And he's right. Like, he can pretty much get away with anything. You know, that's why he can walk behind a bar and start tending, and nobody's going to tell him he has to leave. You know, so. So we went off on a Bill Murray tangent, but we started off by talking about Grease.
Yeah.
So there it is. And heads up to everybody, just a reminder, we do have a Patreon set up. So find us on Patreon and our Facebook page also, A Dearly Departed Podcast on Facebook. Join, and we, you know, the Patreon subscribers, I think the $5 subscribers get early access to the shows, and then all the subscribers, whether it's $2 or $5, get extra mini-episodes that we do between these main ones. So, and the Patreon helps us keep going.
If you want to, if you go to the Facebook page, the Dearly Departed Podcast Facebook page, if you want to support the podcast, and check the Patreon link there. Just not to confuse it with anything else. But the Patreon link for this podcast is at our podcast page on Facebook.
Yes. And we are, if you're out there, we're averaging, I think, somewhere between 12 and 15,000 views and downloads per episode now for the show.
That's cool.
So if anybody listening is a part of an established podcast network, we are always looking for to join a network. An established one, you know, hopefully one of the good ones, so that we can keep, you know, doing this even more. Because if we were to get on a network, we would do this, we would do even more episodes. So everyone wanting us to do more episodes, that's really what it takes. So if anybody out there has good connections to any of the big networks, let us know.
Please.
Reach out.
Please. I would like to say that if any, and I'll say it again, and forgive me because I hate it sounds preachy, but if you're on a boat, wear a life preserver, and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is there. Do a quick Google. People are there to listen. So just take care of yourselves and surround yourselves with people that want to take care of you.
Yes. And we will see you next time.
Thanks. Bye.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.